Stand by here, and I'll get my recorder going. And I have your list here in front of me. It's some pretty thoughtful topics there, so we'll be ready to roll here in just a second.
Okay.
Stand by, and we'll go in 3, 2, 1. Rudy De Leon is Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress and former Deputy Secretary of Defense, talking about his top three for 2013. Rudy, the first item on your list is the dialogue between the United States and China. There are a lot of people that are skeptical about the new regime in China, and our government, of course, staying pretty much the same policy-wise. Do you expect to see any new developments in our relationship with China in the coming year or 2 years?
Well, I think on a variety of fronts, the economic, the political and diplomatic, and then the mill-to-mill, there'll be a fair amount of continuity, although I think there'll be major challenges on the economic side. And then getting the mill-to-mill to a constructive point, I think, will be a real challenge.
The idea of any kind of mill-to-mill is kind of daunting right now, it would seem to me, given some of the aggressive moves that China's made, especially over the last 6 months to a year.
Well, on the mill-to-mill, we've been in a start-stop-restart now for almost 2 decades with either Taiwan or Tiananmen, with big political thorns in the relationship. It seems that on the last trip, Secretary Panetta may have gotten us beyond the stop-start-restart. But that will open the door for an even more challenging task, and that is how to have a meaningful dialogue with the Chinese military and the People's Liberation Army. They've been reluctant to talk in the past, and so I think the burden will be on their side.
The complication there, it seems to me, though, is the fact that the PLA's Navy is obviously ramping up some aggressive weapons systems, the likes of which we haven't seen from that country before.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that the sovereign wealth that China has right now is going to allow it to bring in and to continue to develop new technology or to try and obtain additional technologies from the global marketplace. And many of these technologies are designed specifically to negate unique U.S. capabilities. Anti-access area denial is the term that's often used by the analysts. So getting to some kind of meaningful dialogue with the Chinese is going to be very important.
Now, given the experiences that we and other nations have had with China as far as their willingness to be forthright, can we be confident that if we're able to reach any agreements of any sort with them, that we're going to be able to verify compliance? Or what kind of accountability level of comfort can we find, do you think?
Well, better transparency in the relationship has to be one of the starting points. And here, the nature of how the U.S. military and the whole national security process is structured, one of almost total transparency, as contrasted to the unique relationship of PLA, the People's Liberation Army, really being constructed to serve the Communist Party, and not necessarily the civilian leaders, creates, I think, a unique burden in any kind of mill-to-mill dialogue, in that the lines of the chain of command just aren't clear, and that's a starting point, and it'll be a difficult one in the dialogue.
How much do you think of the aggressive military actions they've taken recently can we chalk up to just their desire to demonstrate to the world that they are a superpower, and how much of it is actual desire to eventually conquer various lands and consolidate their footprint in Asia and other parts of the world?
I think the Chinese do not have a lot of experience in multilateral negotiations. What I mean by that is it's very much an American trait manifested by NATO and our other similar kinds of organizations in Asia to get everyone together at the table, like the South China Sea dialogue. The Chinese, on the other hand, have a tendency of wanting to talk to groups individually, where they can pressure trade agreements against broader geopolitical arrangements. So I think there, the Chinese do not have necessarily the operational sophistication that we would see of the Japanese or the Koreans or other key players. But the South China Sea will be a test very early.
We could probably do an entire show about exactly what the relationship between the United States and China might look like in the coming year. But the second item on your list of top three for 2013 is the budget debate and the Pentagon. And the word that keeps coming up here over and over again, including in what you're writing, is uncertainty. We just don't know what to expect next.
Well, you know, on our total budget, we always have to remember that our national security strength is rooted in our country's economic strength. And so having a budget agreement, as George Bush and Dick Gephardt did in 1990, or Bill Clinton and Bob Dole did several times later in the 90s, where that budget agreement becomes essentially the consensus position, that's very important to our underlying national security strength, and it's particularly important to the Department of Defense, recognizing that in the 90s, when we were on a path to a balanced budget, and we had had a number of deficit reduction initiatives coming from the Senate, the Graham Rudman of the late 80s, and then a series of balanced budget agreements, the DOD pretty much knew early what its top line was going to be, which allowed it to do a lot of planning. We seem to have a new version of start and stop and restart in terms of the budget talks in Washington, and it's going to make it very difficult for the department to have any sense and confidence of its long-term trek here as we go through this decade of the 2010s.
Now, you made a couple of examples there of a president of one party, a congressional leader of the other party. We've seen in the last couple of weeks a lot of focus on the negotiations between President Obama and Speaker Boehner. That seems to have not really gone anywhere. And the last day or so, we're hearing a lot more reports of the president's people talking to the staff of Senator McConnell on the Senate side. Would it make sense to you, would you be surprised if we saw in the next couple of days some kind of agreement among Senator Reid, Senator McConnell, and the president such that the Speaker Boehner is kind of forced to take a vote on the House side and go away from his position of only wanting to pass something that the bulk of the Republican members of the House would go along with?
Well, I think if you look at the numbers in the House, a final agreement is going to have to include Republican votes and Democratic votes. And it can't be just simply dictated in terms so that it's a party line vote. So I think that's very important, and it's important to look at the models of, again, President George Herbert Walker Bush and both Dick Gephardt and George Mitchell there in 1990, a very important budget agreement, and then the later agreements with President Clinton and Senator Dole, that these were things where everybody, you know, to the old Tip O'Neill rule, everybody had something in these agreements that they didn't like. But they were willing to look at the bigger picture and then move together in not necessarily fair compromise, but it was an equitable political compromise.
Rudy De Leon of the Center for American Progress, my guest, talking about his top three for 2013. The third point on your list is the Middle East, and there are so many problem spots there, so many question marks. Are there any there that jump out at you more so than others that could be very prominent in the coming year, or is it all just kind of one big pot that we have to see what rises to the top?
Well, it might be easier if it were all one big pot, but we've got, I think, four areas that just are going to demand constant attention. They're all different. They're all critical. So first, there's Egypt and its attempted transition right now to a democratic form of government with both economic and political reforms on the table. They've just had a referendum on a new constitution that has upset appropriately the 48% who didn't vote for the Muslim Brotherhood in the election. So I think Egypt's transition to a constitutional democracy, certainly Egypt is the cultural and historical center of the Middle East. So huge stakes there. But Iran and Syria have their own stories, their own turbulence. And then, of course, a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. So each of those demand the highest amount of attention. All are critical, and right now all are challenging.
The democratic process in Egypt is particularly problematic, it seems to me, because although it looks from the outside like the Muslim Brotherhood and the current constitution there were arrived at democratically with a majority of the votes, a raw majority of the votes, it doesn't appear that the road forward will be necessarily democratic, as you alluded to with the 48% of people who didn't vote for the Muslim Brotherhood's business model, so to speak. What could we wind up with a situation there where what we have is not much different than what was there under Mubarak?
Well, that would, I think, be a difficult outcome for everyone. You know, one of the things that is that the current Muslim Brotherhood is really pressing is an Islamic key element to the constitutional government, as contrasted to the more secular approach of the Mubarak regime, really for the last 30 years. And so not only will this create political turbulence, but the respect for minority rights in Egypt, for the rights of women, for the rights of Christians, for economic development, all of these things will be pressed. And they're yet unformed in terms of what their outcome will be. And again, Egypt just plays such a huge historical and cultural role in the history of the Middle East. So certainly Egypt will be the focus of our attention, but as I said, Syria and Iran will demand an equal amount of attention, too.
And many people are surprised that Assad continues to hold on in Syria. What is your forecast, I guess, for the way that will end? And I guess the bigger question is, can that end without the United States being involved in one way or another?
Well, certainly all parties that have interests have been reluctant to use military force in what is a civil war. And the most recent effort to get the Russians involved in the negotiations to sort of point the door for the Assad regime don't seem to have been particularly productive. So I think, one, we need a process that will give passage out to Assad and his cohorts when the final end of the administration comes in Syria. And then I think there'll need to be a humanitarian peace that can essentially put some kind of governance together for the country.
It strikes me that involvement on our part in the humanitarian peace, with the outcome at least of the government somewhat determined, if not settled, would be a lot more palatable to people both in Congress and the broader population here in the United States.
Well, I think we want to work with our key ally and NATO member, Turkey. They've got one of the critical borders here, and NATO has just moved in Patriot air defense systems into Turkey to help. But I think it's also very difficult for NATO, for any individual country of the West, to step into what is essentially an internal civil war and not raise a host of other issues. So on one hand, dealing with the humanitarian plight is something that we're all concerned about, and finding a way for the Assad regime to exit and for a new government to be formed is the highest priority. And right now, I think that that should remain the focus.
The situation in Iran, this is my last question, Rudy. I appreciate your time today. The situation in Iran, do we have any indication that as time runs out on Ahmadinejad's term as president, that a transition there will mean anything different policy-wise, or because the Ayatollah is still in control of that country, ultimately, will the disposition toward the United States continue to be the same, do you think?
Well, it seems as though the Ayatollah remains secure in his position as the supreme leader and appears to have the decision-making reins on the nuclear program. So while the elections can certainly change the parliament and the prime minister making sure that messages get into the supreme leader as well as the politically elected regime will be a priority for those that want to support the P5 plus one talks, and also for everyone who is appropriately concerned about halting the spread of nuclear systems, the security of Israel, and the security of other important neighboring countries in the Gulf states.
But I did notice you carefully twice used the word appears regarding the Ayatollah's control on power. Is there any indication to believe that Arab Spring could come back again in the calendar spring and we could see something happen in Iran again as some of the elements inside that country attempted in 2009?
Well, anything is possible, but the Iranian regime is known for its brutality, particularly with young students. So there's not a lot of optimism there, although certainly the fact is that many oppose the rule in Iran right now, and certainly with all of the sanctions taking place, the economic hardships within Iran are significant.
Rudy, that's all I have for you. I am grateful for your time today. Where in California are you spending the holidays?
Oh, just in Los Angeles area.
Oh, fantastic. I lived out there for about 3.5 years in the late 80s, early 90s.